Again, the sound seemed to fill the cellar. "Two blasts," said Nolly. "Black brothers, Northmen, free folk, Thens, Queen's men, all of them fell quiet, listening. 5 heartbeats passed. 10. 20. Then Owen the Oaf tittered, and John Snow could breathe again. 2 blasts," he announced. "Wildlings." Val. Tormund Giantsbane had come at last.
Tyrion. "If you die stupidly, I am going to feed your body to the goats," Tyrion threatened as the first load of stone crows pushed off from the quay. Shagger laughed.
"The half man has no goats. I'll get some just for you."
Dawn was breaking, and pale ripples of light shimmered on the surface of the river, chattering under the poles and reforming when the ferry had passed. Timmet had taken his burn men into the King's Wood 2 days before. Yesterday the Black Ears and Moon Brothers followed. Today the Stone Crows. "Whatever you do, don't try and fight a battle," Tyrion said. "Strike at their camps and baggage train. Ambush their scouts and hang the bodies from trees ahead of their line of march. Loop around and cut down stragglers. I want night attacks. So many and so sudden that they'll be afraid to sleep."
Shagger laid a hand atop Tyrion's head.
"All this I learn from Dolph, son of Holger, before my beard had grown. This is the way of war in the Mountains of the Moon."
"The King's Wood is not the Mountains of the Moon, and you won't be fighting milk snakes and painted dogs. And listen to the guides I'm sending. They know this wood as well as you know your mountains. Heed their counsel, and they'll serve you well."
"Shagger will listen to the half-man's pets,"
the clansman promised solemnly. And then it was time for him to lead his Garen onto the ferry. Tyrion watched them push off and pole out toward the centre of the Blackwater. He felt a queer twinge in the pit of his stomach as Shagger faded in the morning mist. He was going to feel naked without his clansmen. He still had bronze hirelings, near 800 of them now, but sellswords were notoriously fickle. Tyrion had done what he could to buy their continued loyalty, promising Bronn and a dozen of his best men lands and knighthoods when the battle was won. They drunk his wine, laughed at his jests, and called each other Sir until they were all staggering. All but Bronn himself, who only smiled that insolent dark smile of his, and afterwards said,
"They'll kill for that knighthood, but don't ever think they'll die for it."
Tyrion had no such delusion. The gold cloaks were almost as uncertain a weapon. 6,000 men in the city watch, thanks to Cersei, but only a quarter of them could be relied upon.
"There's few out-and-out traitors, though there's some. Even your spider hasn't found them all,"
Bywater had warned him.
"But there's hundreds, greener than spring grass. Men who join for bread and ale and safety. No man likes to look craven in the sight of his fellows. So they'll fight brave enough at the start, when it's all war horns and blowing banners. But if the battle looks to be going sour, they'll break. And they'll break bad. The first man to throw down his spear and run will have 1,000 more trotting on his heels."
To be sure, there were seasoned men in the city watch, the core of 2,000, who'd gotten their gold cloaks from Robert, not Cersei. Yet even those, a watchman was not truly a soldier, Lord Tywin Lannister had been fond of saying. Of knights and squires and men-at-arms, Tyrion had no more than 300. Soon enough, he must test the truth of another of his father's sayings. One man on a wall was worth 10 beneath it. Bronn and the escort were waiting at the foot of the quay, amid swarming beggars, strolling whores, and fishwives crying the catch. The fishwives did more business than all the rest combined. Buyers flocked around the barrels and stalls to haggle over winkles, clams, and river pike. With no other food coming into the city, the price of fish was 10 times what it had been before the war, and still rising. Those who had coin came to the riverfront each morning and each evening, in hopes of bringing home an eel or a pot of red crabs. Those who did not slipped between the stalls, hoping to steal, or stood gaunt and forlorn beneath the walls. The gold cloaks cleared a path through the press, shoving people aside with the shafts of their spears. Tyrion ignored the muttered curses as best he could. A fish came sailing out of the crowd, slimy and rotten. It landed at his feet and flew to pieces. He stepped over it gingerly and climbed into his saddle. Children with swollen bellies were already fighting over pieces of the stinking fish. Mounted, he gazed along the riverfront. Hammers rang in the morning air as carpenters swarmed over the mud gate, extending wooden hoardings from the battlements. Those were coming well. He was a deal less pleased by the clutter of ramshackle structures that had been allowed to grow up behind the quays, attaching themselves to the city walls like barnacles on the hull of a ship. Bait shacks and pot shops, warehouses, merchant stalls, ale houses, the cribs where the cheaper sort of whores spread their legs. It has to go, every bit of it. As it was, Stannis would hardly need scaling ladders to storm the walls. He called Brunn to his side. "Assemble 100 men, and burn everything you see here between the water's edge and the city walls." He waved his stubby finger, taking in all the waterfront squalor. "I want nothing left standing. Do you understand?" The black-haired sellsword turned his head, considering the task. "Them as own all this won't like that much." "I never imagined they would." "So be it. They'll have something else to curse the evil monkey demon for." "Some may fight. See that they lose. What do we do with those that live here?" "Let them have a reasonable time to remove their property and move them out. Try not to kill any of them. They're not the enemy. And no more rapes. Keep your men in line, damn it."
"They are sellswords, not septons," said Bronn. "Next, you'll be telling me you want them sober. It couldn't hurt."
Tyrion only wished he could as easily make city walls twice as tall and 3 times as thick. Though perhaps it did not matter. Massive walls and tall towers had not saved Storm's End, nor Harrenhal, nor even Winterfell. He remembered Winterfell as he had last seen it, not as grotesquely huge as Harrenhal, nor as solid and impregnable to look at as Storm's End, yet there had been a great strength in those stones, a sense that within those walls a man might feel safe. The news of the castle's fall had come as a wrenching shock. "The guards give with one hand and take with the other," he muttered under his breath when Varys told him. They had given the Starks Harrenhal and taken Winterfell, a dismal exchange. No doubt he should be rejoicing. Robb Stark would have to turn north now. If he could not defend his own home and hearth, he was no sort of king at all. It meant reprieve for the West, for House Lannister, and yet Tyrion had only the vaguest memory of Theon Greyjoy from his time with the Starks, a callow youth, always smiling, skilled with a bow. It was hard to imagine him as Lord of Winterfell. The Lord of Winterfell would always be a Stark. He remembered their guardswood, the tall sentinels armoured in their grey-green needles, the great oaks, the hawthorn, and ash, and soldier pines, and at the centre the heart tree standing like some pale giant frozen in time. He could almost smell the place, earthy and brooding, the smell of centuries, and he remembered how dark the wood had been even by day. That wood was Winterfell. It was the north. I never felt so out of place as I did when I walked there. So much an unwelcome intruder. He wondered if the Greyjoys would feel it too. The castle might well be theirs, but never that godswood. not in a year, or 10, or 50. Tyrion Lannister walked his horse slowly toward the Mudgate.
"Winterfell is nothing to you," he reminded himself. "Be glad the place has fallen, and look to your own walls."
The gate was open. Inside, three great trebuchets stood side by side in the market square, peering over the battlements like three huge birds. Their throwing arms were made from the trunks of old oaks and banded with iron to keep them from splitting. The gold cloaks had named them the Three Whores, because they'd be giving Lord Stannis such a lusty welcome.
Or so we hope.
Tyrion put his heels into his horse and trotted through the Mudgate, breasting the human tide. Once beyond the Whores, the press grew thinner, and the street opened up around him. The ride back to the Red Keep was uneventful, but at the Tower of the Hand he found a dozen angry trader captains waiting in his audience chamber to protest the seizure of their ships. He gave them a sincere apology and promised compensation once the war was done. That did little to appease them.
"What if you should lose, my lord?"
one Bravossi asked.
"Then apply to King Stannis for your compensation."
By the time he rid himself of them, bells were ringing, and Tyrion knew he would be late for the installation. He waddled across the yard almost at a run, and crowded into the back of the castle sept, as Joffrey fastened white silk cloaks about the shoulders of the two newest members of his king's guard. The rite seemed to require that everyone stand. So Tyrion saw nothing but a wall of courtly arses. On the other hand, once the new High Septon was finished leading the two knights through their solemn vows and anointing them in the names of the Seven, he would be well positioned to be first out of doors.
He approved of his sister's choice of Sir Balan Swan to take the place of the slain Preston Greenfield. The Swans were marcher lords, proud, powerful, and cautious. Pleading illness, Lord Gullion Swan had remained in his castle, taking no part in the war. But his eldest son had ridden with Renly and now Stannis, while Balon, the younger, served at King's Landing. If he'd had a third son, Tyrion supposed he'd be off with Robb Stark. It was not perhaps the most honourable course, but it showed good sense. Whoever won the Iron Throne, the Swans intended to survive. In addition to being well-born, young Sir Balon was valiant, courtly, and skilled at arms, good with a lance, better with a morning star, superb with a bow. He would serve with honour and courage. Alas, Tyrion could not say the same for Cersei's second choice. Sir Osmond Kettleblack looked formidable enough. He stood 6 feet and 6 inches, most of it sinew and muscle, and his hook nose, bushy eyebrows, and spade-shaped brown beard gave his face a fierce aspect, so long as he did not smile. Low-born, no more than a hedge knight, Kettleblack was utterly dependent on Cersei for his advancement, which was doubtless why she picked him. "Sir Osmond is as loyal as he is brave," she told Joffrey when she put forward his name. It was true, unfortunately. The good Sir Osmond had been selling her secrets to Bronn since the day she hired him, but Tyrion could scarcely tell her that. He supposed he ought not complain. The appointment gave him another ear close to the king, unbeknownst to his sister. And even if Sir Osmond proved an utter craven, he would be no worse than Sir Boris Blunt, currently residing in a dungeon at Rosby. Sir Boris had been escorting Tommen and Lord Joyles when Sir Jaslyn Bywater and his gold cloaks had surprised them, and had yielded up his charge with an alacrity that would have enraged old Sir Barristan Selmy as much as it did Cersei. A knight of the King's Guard was supposed to die in defence of the king and royal family. His sister had insisted that Joffrey strip Blunt of his white cloak on the grounds of treason and cowardice.
And now she replaces him with another man, just as hollow.
The praying, vowing, and anointing seemed to take most of the morning. Tyrion's leg soon began to ache. He shifted his weight from one foot to the other, restless, Lady Tanda stood several rows up, he saw, but her daughter was not with her. He had been half hoping to catch a glimpse of Shay. Varys said she was doing well, but he would prefer to see for himself.
"Better a lady's maid than a pot girl," Shay had said when Tyrion told her the eunuch scheme. "Can I take my belt of silver flowers and my gold collar with the black diamonds you said looked like my eyes? I won't wear them if you say I shouldn't."
Loath as he was to disappoint her, Tyrion had to point out that while Lady Tanda was by no means a clever woman, even she might wonder if her daughter's bedmaid seemed to own more jewellery than her daughter.
"Choose two or three dresses, no more," he commanded her. "Good wool, no silk, no samite, and no fur. The rest I'll keep in my own chambers for when you visit me."
It was not the answer Shay had wanted, but at least she was safe. When the investiture was finally done, Joffrey marched out between Sir Balon and Sir Osmond in their new white cloaks, while Tyrion lingered for a word with the new High Septon, who was his choice, and wise enough to know who'd put the honey on his bread.
"I want the guards on our side," Tyrion told him bluntly. "Tell them that Stannis has vowed to burn the great sept of Baelor." "Is it true, my lord?"
asked the High Septon, a small, shrewd man with a wispy white beard and wizened face. Tyrion shrugged.
"It may be. Stannis burned the god's wood at Storm's End as an offering to the Lord of Light. If he'd offend the old gods, why should he spare the new? Tell them that. Tell them that any man who thinks to give aid to the usurper betrays the gods as well as his rightful king."
I shall, my lord, and I shall command them to pray for the health of the king and his hand as well."
Halin the pyromancer was waiting on him when Tyrion returned to Isola, and Maester Frankin had brought messages. He let the alchemist wait a little longer while he read what the ravens had brought him. There was an old letter from Dorin Martell, warning him that Storm's End had fallen, and a much more intriguing one from Balon Greyjoy, on Pike, who styled himself King of the Isles and the North. He invited King Joffrey to send an envoy to the Iron Islands to fix the borders between their realms and discuss a possible alliance. Tyrion read the letter three times and set it aside. Lord Balon's longships would have been a great help against the fleet sailing up from Storm's End, but they were thousands of leagues away on the wrong side of Westeros, and Tyrion was far from certain that he wanted to give way half the realm.
"Perhaps I should spill this one in Cersei's lap, or take it to the council."
Only then did he admit Halin with the latest tallies from the alchemists.
"This cannot be true," said Tyrion, as he pored over the ledgers. "Almost 13,000 jars? Do you take me for a fool? I'm not about to pay the king's gold for empty jars and pots of sewage, sealed with wax, I warn you."
"No, no," Halin squeaked. "The sums are accurate, I swear. We have been most fortunate, my lord hand. Another cache of Lord Rossart's was found. More than 300 jars under the dragon pit. Some whores have been using the ruins to entertain their patrons, and one of them fell through a patch of rutted floor into a cellar. When he felt the jars, he mistook them for wine. He was so drunk, he broke the seal and drank some."
"There was a prince who tried that once," said Tyrion dryly. "I haven't seen any dragons rising over the city, so it would seem it didn't work this time either."
The dragon pit atop the Hill of Rhaenys had been abandoned for a century and a half. He supposed it was as good a place as any to store wildfire, and better than most. But it would have been nice if the late Lord Rossart had told someone.
300 jars, you say?
That still does not account for these totals. You are several thousand jars ahead of the best estimate you gave me when we last met.
Yes, yes, that's so.
Halin mopped his pale brow with the sleeve of his black and scarlet robe.
We have been working very hard, my lord, and
That would doubtless explain why you are making so much more of the substance than before.
Smiling, Tyrion fixed the pyromancer with his mismatched stare.
Though it does raise the question of why you did not begin working hard until now.
Halen had the complexion of a mushroom, so it was hard to see how he could turn any paler, yet somehow he managed.
We were, my lord, and my brothers and I have been labouring day and night from the first, I assure you. It's only, we have made so much of the substance that we have become more practised, as it were, and also,
the alchemist shifted uncomfortably,
certain spells, ancient secrets of our order, very delicate, very troublesome, but necessary if the substance is to be all it should be.
Tyrion was growing impatient. Sir Jaslyn Bywater was likely here by now, and Iron Hand misliked waiting.
Yes, you have secret spells. How splendid. What of them?
They seem to be working better than they were.
Halen smiled weakly.
You don't suppose there are any dragons about, do you?
Not unless you found one under the dragon pit. Why?
Oh, pardon, I was just remembering something old Wisdom Politor told me once when I was an acolyte. I asked him why so many of our spells seemed, well, not as effectual as the scrolls would have us believe, and he said it was because magic had begun to go out of the world the day the last dragon died.
Sorry to disappoint you, but I've seen no dragons. I have noticed the King's Justice lurking about, however. Should any of these fruits you're selling me turn out to be filled with anything but wildfire, you'll be seeing him as well.
Halen fled so quickly that he almost bowled over Sir Jaslyn. No, Lord Jaslyn. He must remember that. Iron Hand was mercifully direct as ever. He'd returned from Rosby to deliver a fresh levy of spearmen recruited from Lord Giles' estates, and resume his command of the city watch. "How does my nephew fare?" Tyrion asked when they were done discussing the city's defences.
"Prince Tommen is hale and happy, my lord. He has adopted a fawn some of my men brought home from a hunt. He had one once before, he says, but Geoffrey skinned her for a jerkin. He asks about his mother sometimes, and often begins letters to Princess Marcella, though he never seems to finish any. His brother, however, he does not seem to miss at all."
"You have made suitable arrangements for him, should the battle be lost?"
"My men have their instructions."
"Which are?"
"You commanded me to tell no one, my lord."
That made him smile. "I'm pleased you remember.
Should King's Landing fall, he might well be taken alive. Better if he did not know where Joffrey's heir might be found." Varys appeared not long after Lord Jaslyn had left.
"Male are such faithless creatures," he said by way of greeting.
Tyrion sighed. "Who's the traitor today?" The eunuch handed him a scroll.
"So much villainy. It sings a sad song for our age. Did honour die with our fathers?"
"My father is not dead yet." Tyrion scanned the list. "I know some of these names. These are rich men, traders, merchants, craftsmen. Why should they conspire against us?"
"It seems they believe that Lord Stannis must win, and wish to share his victory. They call themselves the Entler Men, after the Crown Stag."
"Someone should tell them that Stannis changed his sigil. Then they can be the Hot Hearts." It was no matter for jest, though. It appeared that these Antler men had armed several hundred followers to seize the old gate once battle was joined, and admit the enemy to the city. Among the names on the list was the master armourer, Sir Lorien.
"Oh, I suppose this means I won't be getting that terrifying helm with the demon horns,"
Tyrion complained, as he scrawled the order for the man's arrest.
Arya. The outriders came on them an hour from the Green Fork, as the wain was slogging down a muddy road. "Keep your head down and your mouth shut," the hound warned her, as the three spurred toward them. A knight and two squires, lightly armoured and mounted on fast palfreys. Clegane cracked his whip at the team, a pair of old drays that had known better days. The wain was creaking and swaying, its two huge wooden wheels squeezing mud up out of the deep ruts in the road with every turn. Stranger followed, tied to the wagon. The big, bad-tempered courser wore neither armour, barding, nor harness, and the hound himself was garbed in splotchy, green rough-spun and a soot-grey mantle with a hood that swallowed his head. So long as he kept his eyes down, you could not see his face, only the whites of his eyes peering out. He looked like some down-at-heels farmer. A big farmer, though. And under the rough-spun was boiled leather and oiled mail, Arya knew. She looked like a farmer's son, or maybe a swineherd. And behind them were four squat casks of salt pork and one of pickled pig's feet. The riders split and circled them for a look before they came up close. Clegane drew the wain to a halt and waited patiently on their pleasure. The knight bore spear and sword, while his squires carried longbows. The badges on their jerkins were smaller versions of the sigil sewn on their master's surcoat, a black pitchfork on a golden bar sinister upon a russet field. Arya had thought of revealing herself to the first outriders they encountered, but she had always pictured grey-cloaked men with a direwolf on their breasts. She might have risked it, even if they'd worn the Umber Giant or the Glover Fist, but she did not know this pitchfork knight or whom he served. The closest thing to a pitchfork she had ever seen at Winterfell was the trident in the hand of Lord Manderley's merman.
"You have business at the Twins?" the knight asked. "Salt pork for the wedding feast, if it please you, sir,"
the hound mumbled his reply, his eyes down, his face hidden.
"Salt pork never pleases me."
The pitchfork knight gave Clegane only the most cursory glance and paid no attention at all to Arya, but he looked long and hard at Stranger. The stallion was no plough horse, that was plain at a glance. One of the squires almost wound up in the mud when the big black courser bit at his own mount.
"How did you come by this beast?"
the pitchfork knight demanded.
"Milady told me to bring him, sir," Clegane said humbly. "He's a wedding gift for young Lord Tully." "What lady? Who is it you serve?"
"Old Lady Went, sir."
"Does she think she can buy her now, back with horse?"
the knight asked. "Gods, is there any fool like an old fool?" Yet he waved them down the road.
"Go on with you, then."
"Aye, my lord."
The hound snapped his whip again, and the old drays resumed their weary trek. The wheels had settled deep into the mud during the halt, and it took several moments for the team to pull them free again. By then the outriders were riding off. Clegane gave them one last look and snorted.
"Sir Donald Haig," he said, "I've taken more horses off him than I can count. Armour as well. Once I near killed him in a melee."
"How come he didn't know you then?" Arya asked.
"Because knights are fools, and it would have been beneath him to look twice at some poxy peasant."
He gave the horses a lick with a whip.
"Keep your eyes down and your tone respectful, and say sir a lot, and most knights will never see you. They pay more mind to horses than to small folk. He might have known Stranger if he'd ever seen me ride him."
"He would have known your face, though." Arya had no doubt of that. Sandor Clegane's burns would not be easy to forget once you saw them. He couldn't hide the scars behind a helm, either. Not so long as the helm was made in the shape of a snarling dog. That was why they needed the wain and the pickled pig's feet.
"I'm not going to be dragged before your brother in chains," the hound had told her, "and I'd just as soon not have to cut through his men to get to him. So we play a little game."
A farmer, chance met on the King's Road,
had provided them with wain, horses, garb, and casks, though not willingly. The hound had taken them at sword point. When the farmer cursed him for a robber, he said, "No, a forager. Be grateful, you get to keep your small clothes. Now, take those boots off, or I'll take your legs off. Your choice." The farmer was as big as Clegane, but all the same, he chose to give up his boots and keep his legs. Evenfall found them still trudging towards the Green Fork and Lord Frey's twin castles. "I'm almost there," Arya thought. She knew she ought to be excited, but her belly was all knotted up tight. Maybe that was just the fever she had been fighting, but maybe not. Last night she had a bad dream, a terrible dream. She couldn't remember what she dreamt of now, but the feeling had lingered all day. If anything, it had only gotten stronger. Fear cuts deeper than swords. She had to be strong now, the way her father told her. There was nothing between her and her mother but a castle gate, a river, and an army. But it was Rob's army, so there was no real danger there. Was there? Roose Bolton was one of them, though. The Leech Lord, as the outlaws called him. That made her uneasy. She had fled Harrenhal to get away from Bolton, as much as from the Bloody Mummers, and she'd had to cut the throat of one of his guards to escape. Did he know she'd done that? Or did he blame Gendry or Hutpie? Would he have told her mother? What would he do if he saw her? "He probably won't even know me." She looked more like a drowned rat than a lord's cupbearer these days. A drowned boy rat. The hound had hacked handfuls of her hair off only 2 days past. He was an even worse barber than Yoren, and he'd left her half bald on one side. "Rob won't know me either, I bet. Or even mother." She had been a little girl the last time she saw them, the day Lord Eddard Stark left Winterfell. They heard the music before they saw the castle, the distant rattle of drums, the brazen blare of horns, the thin skirling of pipes, faint beneath the growl of the river and the sound of the rain beating on their heads. "We've missed the wedding," the hound said, "but it sounds as though the feast is still going. I'll be rid of you soon." "No, I'll be rid of you," Arya thought. The road had been running mostly at northwest, but now it turned due west between an apple orchard and a field of drowned corn beaten down by the rain. They passed the last of the apple trees and crested a rise, and the castles, river, and camps all appeared at once. There were hundreds of horses and thousands of men, most of them milling about the three huge feast tents that stood side by side facing the castle gates, like three great canvas longhalls. Rob had made his camp well back from the walls, on higher, drier ground, but the Green Fork had overflown its bank and even claimed a few carelessly placed tents. The music from the castles was louder here. The sound of the drums and horns rolled across the camp. The musicians in the nearer castle were playing a different song than the ones in the castle on the far bank, though. So it sounded more like a battle than a song. "They're not very good," Arya observed. The hound made a sound that might have been a laugh. "Yeah, there's old deaf women in Lannisport complaining of the din, I'll warrant. I'd heard Walter Frey's eyes were failing, but no one mentioned his bloody ears." Arya found herself wishing it were day. If the sun was out and the wind was blowing, she would have been able to see the banners better. She would have looked for the direwolf of Stark, or maybe the Serwyn battle axe or the Glover fist. But in the gloom of night, all the colours looked grey. The rain had dwindled down to a fine drizzle, almost a mist. But an earlier downpour had left the banners wet as dish rags, sudden and unreadable. A hedge of wagons and carts had been drawn up along the perimeter to make a crude wooden wall against any attack. That was where the guards stopped them. The lantern their sergeant carried shed enough light for Arya to see that his cloak was a pale pink spotted with red teardrops. The men under him had the Leech Lord's badge sewn over their hearts, the flayed man of the Dreadfort. Sandor Clegane gave them the same tale he'd used on the Outriders, but the Bolton sergeant was a harder sort of nut than Sir Donald Haig had been.
"Salt pork's no fit meat for a lord's wedding feast," he said scornfully. "Got pickled pig's feet too, sir." "Not for the feast, you don't. The feast I've done, and I'm a Northman, not some milk-sock southern knight. I was told to see the steward or the cook. Castle's closed. The lordling's not to be disturbed." The sergeant considered for a moment. "You can unload by the feast tents there." He pointed with a mailed hand. "Ale makes a man hungry, and Alfrey won't miss a few pig's feet. He don't have the teeth for such anyhow. Ask for Sedgkins. He'll know what's to be done with you." He barked a command, and his men rolled one of the wagons aside for them to enter. The hound's whip spurred the team toward the tents. No one seemed to pay them any mind. They splashed past rows of brightly coloured pavilions, their walls of wet silk lit up like magic lanterns by lamps and braziers inside. Pink and gold and green they glimmered, striped and fretty and checky, emblazoned with birds and beasts, chevrons and stars, wheels and weapons. Arya spotted a yellow tent with six acorns on its panels. 3-2-1. Lord Smallwood, she knew, remembering Acorn Hall, so far away, and the lady who said she was pretty. But for every shimmering silk pavilion, there were 24 of felt or canvas, opaque and dark. There were barracks tents, too, big enough to shelter 20 foot soldiers, though even those were dwarfed by the 3 great feast tents. The drinking had been going on for hours, it seemed. Arya heard shouted toasts and the clash of cups, mixed with all the usual camp sounds, horses whinnying and dogs barking, wagons rumbling through the dark, laughter and curses, the clank and clatter of steel and wood. The music grew still louder as they approached the castle, but under that was a deeper, darker sound. The river, the swollen green fork, growling like a lion in its den. Arya twisted and turned, trying to look everywhere at once, hoping for a glimpse of a direwolf badge, for a tent done up in grey and white, for a face she knew from Winterfell. All she saw were strangers. She stared at a man relieving himself in the reeds, but he wasn't Alebelly. She saw a half-dressed girl burst from a tent laughing, but the tent was pale blue, not grey, like she'd thought at first, and the man who went running after her wore a tree cat on his doublet, not a wolf. Beneath a tree, 4 archers were slipping wax strings over the notches of their longbows, but they were not her father's archers. A maester crossed their path, but he was too young and thin to be Maester Lewin. Arya gazed up at the twins, their high tower windows glowing softly wherever a light was burning. Through the haze of rain, the castles looked spooky and mysterious, like something from one of old Nan's tales, but they weren't Winterfell. The press was thickest at the feast tents. The wide flaps were tied back, and men were pushing in and out with drinking horns and tankards in their hands, some with camp followers. Arya glanced inside as the hound drove past the first of the 3 and saw hundreds of men crowding the benches and jostling around the casks of mead and ale and wine. There was hardly room to move inside, but none of them seemed to mind. At least they were warm and dry. Cold, wet Arya envied them. Some were even singing. The fine misty rain was steaming all around the door, from the heat escaping from inside. "Here's to Lord Edmure and Lady Rosalind," she heard a voice shout. They all drank, and someone yelled, "Here's to the young wolf and Queen Jane!" "Who is Queen Jane?" Arya wondered briefly. The only queen she knew was Cersei. Fire pits had been dug outside the feast tents, sheltered beneath rude canopies of woven wood and hides that kept the rain out so long as it fell straight down. The wind was blowing off the river, though, so the drizzle came in anyway, enough to make the fires hiss and swirl. Serving men were turning joints of meat on spits above the flames. The smells made Arya's mouth water. "Shouldn't we stop?" she asked Sandor Clegane. "There's Northmen in the tents." She knew them by their beards, by their faces, by their cloaks of bearskin and sealskin, by their half-heard toasts and the songs they sang. Carstarks and umbers
and men of the mountain clans. I bet there are Winterfell men, too. Her father's men, the Young Wolf's men, the Direwolves of Stark.
Your brother will be in a castle, he said. Your mother, too. You want them or no?
Yes, she said. What about Sedgkins? The sergeant had told them to ask for Sedgkins.
Sedgkins can bugger himself with a hot poker.
Clegane shook out his whip and set it hissing through the soft rein to bite at a horse's flank.
It's your bloody brother I want.
Daenerys. The hall rang to Yunkish laughter, Yunkish songs, Yunkish prayers. Dancers danced, musicians played queer tunes with bells and squeaks and bladders. Singers sang ancient love songs in the incomprehensible tongue of old Gith. Wine flowed, not the thin pale stuff of Slaver's Bay, but rich sweet vintages from the Arbor, and dream wine from Carth, flavoured with strange spices. The Yunkai had come at King Hisdar's invitation to sign the peace and witness the rebirth of Meereen's far-famed fighting pits. Her noble husband had opened the Great Pyramid to fate them.
I hate this, thought Daenerys Targaryen. How did this happen, that I'm drinking and smiling with men I'd sooner flay?
A dozen different sorts of meat and fish were served. Camel, crocodile, singing squid, lacquered ducks, and spiny grubs, with goat and ham and horse for those whose tastes were less exotic, plus dog. No Giscari feast was complete without a course of dog. Hisdar's cooks prepared dog four different ways.
Giscari will eat anything that swims or flies or crawls, but for man and dragon,
Dario had warned her.
And I'll wager they'll eat dragon too, if given half a chance.
Meat alone does not make a meal, though. So there were fruits and grains and vegetables as well. The air was redolent with the scents of saffron, cinnamon, cloves, pepper and other costly spices. Danny scarce touched a bite.
This is peace, she told herself. This is what I wanted, what I worked for. This is why I married Hisdar. So why does it taste so much like defeat?
It is only for a little while more, my love, Hisdar had assured her. The Yunkai will soon be gone, and their allies and hirelings with them. We shall have all we desired, peace, food, trade. Our port is open once again, and ships are being permitted to come and go.
They are permitting that, yes, she had replied. But their warships remain. They can close their fingers around our throat again whenever they wish. They have opened a slave market within sight of my walls.
Outside our walls, sweet queen, and that was a condition of the peace, that Yunkai would be free to trade in slaves as before, unmolested.
In their own city, not where I have to see it.
The wise masters had established their slave pens and auction block just south of the Skarhazadan, where the wide brown river flowed into Slaver's Bay.
They are mocking me to my face, making a show of how powerless I am to stop them.
Posing and posturing, said her noble husband. A show, as you have said. Let them have their mummery. When they are gone, we will make a fruit market of what they leave behind.
When they are gone, Danny repeated. And when will they be gone? Riders have been seen beyond the Skarhazadan. Dothraki scouts, Rakaro says, with a Khalasar behind them. They will have captives, men, women, and children, gifts for the slavers.
Dothraki did not buy or sell, but they gave gifts and received them.
That is why the Yunkai have thrown up this market. They will leave here with thousands of new slaves.
Hisdar Zolorek shrugged. But they will leave. That is the important part, my love. Yunkai will trade in slaves. Meereen will not.
This is what we have agreed. Endure this for a little while longer, and it shall pass. So Daenerys sat silent through the meal, wrapped in a vermilion toca and black thoughts, speaking only when spoken to, brooding on the men and women being bought and sold outside her walls, even as they feasted here within the city. Let her noble husband make the speeches and laugh at the feeble Yunkish japes. That was a king's right, and a king's duty. Much of the talk about the table was of the matches to be fought upon the morrow. Barsena Blackhair was going to face a boar, his tusks against her dagger. Kraz was fighting, as was the spotted cat. And in the day's final pairing, Gogor the giant would go against Bellaquo Bonebreaker. One would be dead before the sun went down. "No queen has clean hands," Dany told herself. She thought of Doria, of Quaro, of Eroa, of a little girl she had never met, whose name had been Hazea. "Better a few should die in the pit than thousands at the gates. This is the price of peace. I pay it willingly. If I look back, I am lost." The Yunkish supreme commander, Yerkes Zoyunzak, might have been alive during Aegon's conquest, to judge by his appearance. Bent-backed, wrinkled, and toothless, he was carried to the table by two strapping slaves. The other Yunkish lords were hardly more impressive. One was small and stunted, though the slave soldiers who attended him were grotesquely tall and thin. The third was young, fit, and dashing, but so drunk that Danny could scarce understand a word he said.
"How could I have been brought to this pass by creatures such as these?"
The sellswords were a different matter. Each of the four free companies serving Yunkai had sent its commander. The Windblown were represented by the Pentoshi nobleman known as the Tattered Prince, the Long Lancers by the Gyro Regan, who looked more shoemaker than soldier, and spoke in murmurs. Bloodbeard, from the company of the cat, made enough noise for him and a dozen more. A huge man with a great bush of beard and a prodigious appetite for wine and women. He bellowed, belched, farted like a thunderclap, and pinched every serving girl who came within his reach. From time to time he would pull one down into his lap to squeeze her breasts and fondle her between the legs. The second sons were represented too.
"If Dario were here, this meal would end in blood."
No promised peace could have ever persuaded her captain to permit Brown Ben Plum to stroll back into Meereen and leave alive. Danny had sworn that no harm would come to the seven envoys and commanders, though that had not been enough for the Yunkai. They had required hostages of her as well. To balance the three Yunkish nobles and four sellswort captains, Meereen sent seven of its own out to the siege camp. Hisdar's sister, two of his cousins, Dany's blood rider, Jogo, her admiral, Grolio, the unsullied captain, Hero, and Dario Naharis. "I will leave my girls with you," her captain had said, handing her his sword belt and its gilded wantons. "Keep them safe from me, beloved. We would not want them making bloody mischief amongst the Yunkai." The shaved pate was absent as well. The first thing Hisdar had done upon being crowned was to remove him from command of the brazen beasts, replacing him with his own cousin, the plump and pasty Marga Zolorek.
"It is for the best. The Green Grace says there is blood between Lorek and Kandak, and the shaved pate never made a secret of his disdain for my lord husband. And Dario..."
Dario had only grown wilder since her wedding. Her peace did not please him. Her marriage pleased him less. And he had been furious at being deceived by the Dornishmen. When Prince Quentin told them that the other Westerosi had come over to the Stormcrows, at the command of the Tattered Prince, only the intercession of Grey Worm and his unsolid prevented Dario from killing them all. The forced deserters had been imprisoned safely in the bowels of the pyramid, but Dario's rage continued to fester.
"He will be safer as a hostage. My captain was not made for peace."
Danny could not risk his cutting down of Brown Ben Plum, making muck of Hisdar before the court, provoking the Yunkai, or otherwise upsetting the agreement that she had given up so much to win. Dario was war and woe. Henceforth, she must keep him out of her bed, out of her heart, and out of her. If he did not betray her, he would master her. She did not know which of those she feared the most. When the gluttony was done, and all the half-eaten food had been cleared away, to be given to the boar, who gathered below, at the queen's insistence, tall glass flutes were filled with a spice liquor from Carth, as dark as amber. Then began the entertainments. A troop of Yunkish castrati, owned by Yerkes Zoyunzak, sang them songs in the ancient tongue of the old empire, their voices high and sweet and impossibly pure.
"Have you ever heard such singing, my love?" Hisdar asked her. "They have the voices of gods, do they not?" "Yes," she said, "though I wonder if they might not have preferred to have the fruits of men."
All of the entertainers were slaves. That had been part of the peace, that slave owners be allowed the right to bring their chattel into Meereen without fear of having them freed. In return, the Yunkai had promised to respect the rights and liberties of the former slaves that Danny had freed. "A fair bargain," Hisdar said, but the taste it left in the queen's mouth was foul. She drank another cup of wine to wash it out.
"If it please you, Yerkes will be pleased to give us the singers, I do not doubt," her noble husband said. "A gift to seal our peace, an ornament to our court."
"He will give us these castrati," Danny thought, "and then he will march home and make some more. The world is full of boys." The tumblers who came next failed to move her either, even when they formed a human pyramid 9 levels high, with a naked little girl on top.
"Is that meant to represent my pyramid?"
the queen wondered.
"Is the girl on top meant to be me?"
Afterward, her lord husband led his guests onto the lower terrace, so the visitors from the Yellow City might behold Meereen by night. Wine cups in hand, the Yunkai wandered the garden in small groups, beneath lemon trees and night-blooming flowers, and Danny found herself face to face with Brown Ben Plum. He bowed low.
"Worship, you look lovely. Well, you always did. None of them Yunkish men are half so pretty. I thought I might bring a wedding gift for you, but the bidding went too high for old Brown Ben."
"I want no gifts from you."
"This one you might, the head of an old foe."
"Your own," she said sweetly. "You betrayed me."
"Now that's a harsh way of putting it, if you don't mind me saying."
Brown Ben scratched at his speckled grey and white whiskers.
"We went over to the winning side, is all. Same as we done before. It weren't all me, neither. I put it to my men."
"So they betrayed me. Is that what you're saying? Why? Did I mistreat the second sons? Did I cheat you on your pay?"
"Never that," said Brown Ben. "But it's not all about the coin, your high and mightiness. I learned that a long time back at my first battle. Morning after the fight, I was rooting through the dead, looking for the odd bit of plunder, as it were. Came upon this one corpse. Some axeman had taken his whole arm off at the shoulder. He was covered with flies, all crusty, with dried blood. Might be why no one else had touched him, but under them he wore this studded jerkin, looked to be good leather. I figured it might fit me well enough. So I chased away the flies and cut it off him. The damn thing was heavier than it had any right to be, though.
Under the lining, he'd sown a fortune in coin. Gold, your worship, sweet yellow gold. Enough for any man to live like a lord for the rest of his days. But what good did it do him? There he was, with all his coin lying in the blood and mud, with his fucking arm cut off. And that's a lesson, see? Silver's sweet and gold's our mother, but once you're dead, they're worth less than that last shit you take as you lie dying. I told you once, there are old sellswords and there are bold sellswords, but there are no old bold sellswords. My boys didn't care to die, that's all. And when I told them that you couldn't unleash them dragons against the Yunkishmen, well...
You saw me as defeated, Danny thought. And who am I to say that you were wrong? I understand.
She might have ended it there, but she was curious.
Enough gold to live like a lord, you said. What did you do with all that wealth?
Brown Ben laughed. Fool boy that I was. I told a man I took to be my friend, and he told our sergeant and my brothers in arms, come and relieve me of that burden. Sergeant said I was too young, that I'd only wasted all on whores and such. He let me keep the jerkin, though, he spat. You don't never want to trust a sellsword, milady.
I have learned that much. One day I must be sure to thank you for the lesson.
Brown Ben's eyes crinkled up.
No need. I know the sort of thanks you have in mind.
He bowed again and moved away. Danny turned to gaze out over her city. Beyond her walls, the yellow tents of the Yunkai stood in orderly rows beside the sea, protected by the ditches their slaves had dug for them. Two armed legions out of New Gis, trained and armed in the same fashion as Unsullied, were encamped across the river to the north. Two more Gascari legions had made camp to the east, choking off the road to the Kaizai Pass. The horse lines and cook fires of the free companies lay to the south. By day, thin plumes of smoke hung against the sky like ragged grey ribbons. By night, distant fires could be seen. Hard by the bay was the abomination, the slave market, at her door. She could not see it now, with the sunset, but she knew that it was there. That just made her angrier.
Sir Barristan,
she said softly. The white knight appeared at once.
Your Grace?
How much did he hear?
Enough. He was not wrong. Never trust a sellsword.
Or a queen, thought Danny. Is there some man in the Second Sons who might be persuaded to remove Brown Ben?
As Dario Naharis once removed the other captains of the Storm Crows, the old knight looked uncomfortable.
Perhaps. I would not know, Your Grace. No, she thought. You are too honest and too honourable. If not, the Yunkai employ three other companies.
Rogues and cutthroats, scum of 100 battlefields, Sir Barristan warned, with captains full as treacherous as plum.
I'm only a young girl and know little of such things, but it seems to me that we want them to be treacherous. Once, you'll recall, I convinced the Second Sons and Stormcrows to join us.
If Your Grace wishes a privy word with Gilo Reagan or the Tattered Prince, I could bring them up to your apartments.
This is not the time. Too many eyes, too many ears. Their absence would be noted, even if you could separate them discreetly from the Yunkai. We must find some quieter way of reaching out to them. Not tonight, but soon.
As you command. Though I fear this is not a task for which I am well suited. In King's Landing, work of this sort was left to Lord Littlefinger or the Spider. We old knights are simple men, only good for fighting. He patted his sword hilt.
Our prisoners, suggested Danny, the Westerosi who came over from the Windblown with the 3 Dornishmen. We still have them in cells, do we not? Use them.
Free them, you mean? Is that wise? They were sent here